ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, the Nanup 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Has Hollywood literally found its missionary zeal? Religious depictions on screens, big and small, are booming. This is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. That story is soon. As Israel and the United States continue their war with Iran, even promising to assassinate the new hardline Ayatollah, Pope Leo has emerged as a champion of international law. He wants an immediate ceasefire. Tens of millions of people may be hearing him, but does Jerusalem, Washington, and Tehran care? Leo knows about the brutal history of Iran's regime, but worries about strong nations acting without restraint. Dr. Miles Pattenden of Oxford University is a papal historian.
Pope Leo has expressed a great deal of concern about what's going on in Iran. He's emphasized the potential here for a tragedy of enormous proportions. He's asked both sides to de-escalate and to halt the spiral of violence. And he's very concerned, of course, about the tragedy of deaths, especially civilian deaths, and everything that could go wrong. So he's spoken out with increasing force on this subject over the course of the last week, and I expect he'll continue to do so.
I guess the question is, though, Miles, is anyone listening to him? I mean, I'm actually sure that tens of millions of people are listening to him, but are the decision makers when it comes to this war listening to him?
Well, that has always been the problem for popes who put themselves into these positions. And history, as a guide, suggests that no, the decision makers probably aren't going to be terribly influenced by what he has to say. This was a problem for the popes of the 20th century. Each time a major war flared up, when they expressed their concern for humanitarian issues, mostly both sides ignored them and, in fact, were suspicious that Pope secretly supported the other side. That's something which is probably continuing now. I can't really see that the Pope has much influence on Donald Trump. And of course, you have no influence at all over the Iranian clerics or Benjamin Netanyahu.
I guess the only sort of leverage he might have when it comes to Donald Trump is Pope Leo may influence the Catholics in the United States, on whom Donald Trump relies, at least a segment of them, for his victory.
That is true. The Pope could influence those Catholics, but the Pope has a difficult and probably impossible calculation on this kind of thing, because he claims to be a leader who speaks, in a sense, for the whole of humanity. He's a universal leader. And so he needs to say things which sum up everybody's position. He doesn't want to alienate particular constituencies. The problem is that that has tended to lead popes to make formulations of the kind that we've heard from Leo over the past week or so, in which he expresses very general points, but he isn't, in fact, sort of blaming one side or the other or developing these arguments, even though, you know, the Catholic tradition has a very deep and long discussion of many of the points which are now extremely salient. It's easy to say that death is wrong and is tragic, but under what circumstances might a death be justified? Might war itself be justified? The Bible gives potentially contradicting positions on this kind of thing. Everybody knows the Bible verse from Matthew where Jesus says, turn the other cheek. But there are other stories which suggest that actually that kind of unequivocal pacifism, which has been a strong strand of Christian thought over the last two millennia, that isn't the only possibility. And you think of something like the story of the Good Samaritan, you know, the moral of that could well be, well, you can't just walk by on the other side of the street consumed by your own self-righteousness. Sometimes you have to help. Sometimes there are circumstances where you have to make sacrifices. The question is, what are those circumstances? What's a proportionate sacrifice? You know, how much bad can you tolerate in the pursuit of a greater good. And these are the questions which have animated Catholic moral theology since at least the time of St. Augustine. And that's the kind of stuff that popes could comment on, but they're very reluctant to do so at a certain level because, you know, the conclusions from that might be unpalatable. They might be things that people don't want to hear that alienate certain kinds of Catholics or certain constituencies within the Catholic Church. And so popes tend to play it safe. And we're seeing the same with Leo right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the language is apposite. The Pope does have in his quote unquote armory the just war theory. I'll come to that in a moment. Leo, though, does seem to place a great deal of emphasis on international law. Why?
I think that partly is simply because it reflects the dominant mode of thinking of respectable opinion, particularly around the Western world. This has become a kind of bulwark and benchmark of civilized behavior between nations and peoples, and Leo buys into that consensus. And it's important that he does, because if he didn't do, probably, and certainly governments would pay him very little attention. But, you know, a lot of Catholics would raise their eyebrows as well. The problem is we are at a moment when that consensus is starting to break down. There are, in fact, now quite a lot of political actors who say, well, international law is all very well, but... And it's very difficult for the Pope because now he, in a sense, has to pick sides. It's natural that he takes the cautious position, which is to continue to support what has been the status quo. The difficulties he's finding now over how to articulate his position on this reflect the fact that the world is itself changing.
But Miles, should we be surprised at all that Pope Leo is doing his best to emphasize international law and multilateral institutions? I mean, the Catholic Church in the post-war era was one of the architects, wasn't it, of the post-war multilateral architecture. You know, Catholic statesmen were very much behind elements of the United Nations and the European Union. The Vatican is quite invested in this idea of multilateral institutions, isn't it?
Yes, it has been through much of the 20th century, and for the reasons that you just gave. I mean, a lot of it comes down to the trauma and the tragedy of World War I and World War II, where these things didn't exist. And of course, you know, there was a catastrophe on an unprecedented scale around Europe. And the papacy itself came across as really largely impotent during those conflicts. So it's not surprising that popes after the war started to invest in these ideas, to invest in the idea that Catholic politicians around Europe and the United States should come together to create an architecture that achieved, in a sense, what Benedict XV in World War I and possibly Pius XII in World War II hadn't been able to achieve. But the problem is that that consensus amongst the politicians is probably gone, and Leo now needs to react to that.
How much does he see himself, in a sense, as a rival for the attention of the American people? He's the first American pope, and this has been talked about in almost the year since he assumed the papacy, that he would be the alternative American voice to Donald Trump. I'm wondering if that is playing into it. I know it's not his overt intention, but I'm wondering if this is informing some of his statements on the war on Iran.
It might well be. And there are two ways of reading the way that Leo has played it so far. On the one hand, we could say that he's playing a long game. He's come up with statements that hint at criticism of President Trump and certainly suggest that he takes a very different view about a number of key issues. But it's measured and it's cautious. Now, that could be because Leo is quietly replacing some of the more conservative American bishops with more liberal ones, and that over time we'll see that his confidence in speaking out against conservative government policies in the United States increases. That's very possible. Or it could equally be that actually Leo is very cautious and doesn't quite know what to do, and what we see is a kind of hesitation and indecision about this kind of thing. But there's no doubt there is great potential for the Pope to speak out and to be very influential in opposing Trump's policy. The risk, though, of course, is that American Catholics, a majority of whom voted for the Republicans in 2024, that they won't follow him.
Leo does have at his disposal a key indicator of whether a conflict is acceptable, and that is the just war theory. There's a wrinkle in this, of course, but first of all, what does the just war theory very briefly suggest, and how might it apply to Iran?
The just war theory says a war can be just if it fulfills certain criteria. It has to be waged by a legitimate authority, it has to be for a just cause, and it has to be undertaken with the right intention. Perhaps also that, you know, it has to be proportional. The good that you're going to do by fighting the war must exceed the bad that you will also inevitably do. The problem with this as a theory is, of course, how it translates into practice in particular instances. And that is what is probably difficult for Catholics now. We take even one aspect of it. Thomas Aquinas and Augustine, they say, well, you know, war should always be a last resort. But what qualifies as a last resort? Should America wait until Iran actually has nuclear weapons? Is that the moment, or is the last resort the moment just before they have nuclear weapons, or the moment just before it becomes inevitable that they can have them? You can argue over this almost endlessly. So the theory needs to be applied in practice, and the difficulty is in how you do that. This is one area where the Pope so far has been quite vague. He hasn't really developed a sophisticated framework in explaining this, or, you know, when it says a legitimate authority, well, the Pope is very firm at the moment that the legitimate authority is the United Nations and the system, the international framework of multilateral institutions. But what if they don't work? What if they're clearly no longer able to meet the challenge?
The wrinkle in the just war theory, as Pope Leo would have to deal with it, is that didn't Pope Francis effectively abolish the just war theory? As I recall, he said something like, in an era of weapons of mass destruction, it's impossible to have proportionate response. So the Vatican's own position on the just war theory is unclear, isn't it?
But the Vatican's position on these things is always going to be unclear. And Pope Francis didn't rule this ex cathedra, so Leo can simply say, I don't agree with my predecessor, or he was speaking in a general context, whereas this is a much more specific one. There's always a way to get around these arguments.
Dr. Miles Pattenden, he is a historian at Deakin University and the University of Oxford. He's a specialist in the history of the Vatican. Miles, thanks for coming back to the program.
Thank you very much.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National. You're hearing about the links between religion, ethics, and the news that shapes the world. In a special episode of Big Ideas this week, the Religion and Ethics team explores the religious roots of anti-Jewish prejudice. A key turning point came in the 1800s when a racialized anti-Semitism began to supplant religious bigotry, the most lethal consequences, of course, in the 1930s and 40s. Jeff Levy of the University of New South Wales speaks with me and my colleague Scott Stevens.
These ideas about racial superiority that were percolating in 19th century Europe, which actually go back to the early 19th century. Somebody like Count Gobineau, who was a French writer and diplomat, was talking about the superiority of the Aryan and Nordic races. Darwin, of course, writes, is on The Origin of the Species, 1859, and his ideas are exploited in terms of social Darwinism, trying to create a hierarchy among the races. And it's probably not coincidental that just as the Jews were successfully assimilating and losing their distinctiveness, both in terms of their practices and in terms of their dress and their appearance, a new form of anti-Jewish prejudice arose, something that couldn't appeal to their Jewish practices, but what it did appeal to and what joined all Jews was the blood that ran through their veins. This is the biological racism that is known as anti-Semitism.
And Jeff, you do have two things, it seems to me, running hand in hand here that are really quite troubling. One is the purported scientific basis for racism, the fact, if you like, of an inferior race. But then you also have the problem that was presented by the requirement that many Jews needed to effectively convert to Christianity in order to gain entry into Christian society. It almost seems as though the scientific and the religious here were going in a really uncomfortable way hand in hand.
Yeah, and there are differences here. For example, in Germany, Jews could organize collectively, but they couldn't enter the state, as you point out, unless they converted. But in France, they could be officers of the state without converting, but they couldn't really organize collectively. You know, French republicanism meant that you needed to respect civil equality by kind of hiding your private identities. There are these tensions between the old anti-Jewish prejudice based on the condemnation of the Jews as Christ killers and Christ deniers, and then the racial anti-Semitism of the latter 19th century based on pseudo-scientific ideas rather than scientific ideas.
And these things really did come to a head, of course, with the Final Solution in Germany. There remains debate among historians, doesn't there, about Hitler's own faith. In his own writings, he says that his favorite passage in the New Testament is the story of that great Aryan Jesus' expulsion of the Jews from the temple. He says, except now in the hands of the Nazi state, it's not the whip, but the blackjack.
Yeah. Yeah, the Holocaust depended on several modern ideas. There's a sense in which it could only have happened at least in the 20th century. One of the things that it depended on was a very extensive bureaucracy for mass extermination. The second thing it depended upon was technology. To mass exterminate so many people required new technology. In this case, it was Zyklon B gas. And the third thing it depended on, which wasn't new, was political will. It's sometimes said that Hitler, the only thing original about Hitler was not his ideas for mass extermination, but he went ahead and did it. But it also depended on this idea of the purity of the ethnic nation.
Yeah.
And that's a modern idea, that for a state to be successful, especially if you believe in the superiority of your ethnic group, of the ethnic majority, it needs to maintain its homogeneity, and therefore any minority group represents a threat. And I might just add here, it's sometimes said that modern Jewish history has two terminal points. 1781, which is the date of the essay on the civil improvement of the Jews by Christian Wilhelm von Dohm, in which he argues for Jewish civil equality. So that terminal point, in shorthand, could be called total assimilation. And the second terminal point is 1942, the von Sieb Conference, where the final solution is thought through and administered. And it's said that between those two terminal points, there's a common assumption, and that is the elimination of Jews as a discernible entity on German soil. And there is something to that argument. They're both engaged in the disappearance, if you like, of Jewish distinctiveness. The caution I would add is that there's a world of difference between assimilation and extermination.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Levy of the University of New South Wales. You can find the full Big Ideas special on the religious roots of anti-Semitism at ABC Listen or through the link at our website. And you're with me, Andrew West. Nobel Peace Prize winner the Dalai Lama has added a more unusual award to his collection, a Grammy for the Best Spoken Word Book Recording. It's another example of how religion and popular culture are deeply enmeshed. The US-based Faith and Media Initiative finds that audiences, including those with no religious belief, love religious themes on the big and small screen. Professor Anna Halifoff of Deakin University specializes in faith and popular culture.
The Dalai Lama is an internationally recognized expert, and Buddhism, I think, has broad popular appeal. And I think Buddhism also, since its kind of real popularity kind of boom in the 90s, has also always had quite a strong connection, Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama, with celebrities. So you think about people like Richard Gere, like there's some good marketing in here too, wanting to spread the teachings as widely as possible through combining that with some popular culture.
Yeah, there's no doubt the Dalai Lama is a beloved figure. He's actually a very serious man too. I've interviewed him for more than an hour. And he's very serious in his appeals for world peace and reconciliation. Does winning the Grammy in reality do anything to win converts to Buddhism or the cause of Tibet, by the way? I mean, I noticed the Chinese government was rather ticked off that he won the Grammy Award.
Winning the Grammy gives legitimacy to the Dalai Lama and thereby also to the Tibet movement and the Tibetan cause to be recognized and to be respected, and for the human rights of Tibetans to be respected. And so that is threatening.
Anna, there's some fascinating new research out of the US, the Faith and Media Initiative. It looks at the depiction of religion in movies and television. Broadly speaking, what does that research find?
It's really interesting because it's showing the salience of religious themes to a contemporary audience that is diverse religiously. And not just diverse religiously, but also spiritually. They asked people to identify whether they were religious or spiritual or a person of faith. And in their whole sample, they get around, 78% of people say that they identify as being spiritual, religious, or a person of faith, and only around 22% that say they are none of these things.
I mean, the other really fascinating thing about this study is that viewers of movies and television who were atheists or agnostics were far more captivated and, I'm not going to say converted, but certainly persuaded, drawn in by religious narratives on film and TV. I found that extraordinary.
Yeah, it is really interesting.
Why?
Well, I would guess that, or posit, that it is related to something that we call contact theory. If you are a strongly non-religious person, then in your everyday life, you might not have that much contact with religion or with spirituality. And so then through the consumption of this type of media, then you might get a deeper understanding of it. So I don't read in the data that it leads to any sort of conversion experience, but that people who are not religious and then watch this type of media become more open to seeing this type of content through experiencing it and learning something from it, perhaps even.
There's a long history of the depiction of religion and religious figures in movies. I mean, whether it's Julie Andrews as Maria von Trapp, the novice nun in The Sound of Music who softens the heart of a grieving widower, or perhaps more recently a show that a lot of people who listen to this program might have watched, which was The West Wing. Jeb Bartlett, who was the Liberal Democratic president in The West Wing, he was a very religious figure, wasn't he?
I would completely agree with you that, you know, Hollywood and more recently television has long had an interest in depicting religious narratives and also religious characters. The research is showing that there has been kind of like a boom in this type of particularly Christian TV and media. You see that in shows like The Chosen. You see that in the Netflix drama about Mary. Some of this is also funded by, there's, you know, Angel Studios that is Latter-day Saints. In America, because there has been more of a sort of increase of interest in Christianity, we are seeing this reflected in Hollywood.
Yeah, I wonder though how successful that is compared to the more subtle depictions, because they seem to be quite endearing. I mean, I know you weren't a close viewer, maybe not as obsessive as me of The West Wing, but I can recall a very affecting scene in The West Wing where Jed Bartlett is struggling with his conscience over the death penalty, and he invites his priest, and the priest is a reliably kindly, very gentle man who then says, well, Jed, maybe you need to take confession. And he kneels in the Oval Office and takes confession from his priest. I mean, these are very sort of gentle scenes that are quietly persuasive. I get the impression, though, that more tub-thumping depictions of religion may be off-putting.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the major study that we started talking about, yeah, they literally do find that the types of shows that they're quoting people of faith and also non-faith having kind of positive engagement with are shows such as The West Wing, Nobody Wants This, which I have watched, the movie Selma, other shows such as Hacksaw Ridge. It is that more everyday religion that people are engaging with. And I think that also kind of makes sense because despite these predictions of secularization and that religion would completely disappear from public life, what we are seeing from the turn of the 21st century is there is a kind of increase of religion in public life and in politics. It's not just always conservative religion. The other thing we're really seeing an increase of interest in and increase of depiction of is spirituality. Many people around the world and even in Western societies are still religious and or spiritual. And so religious diversity, religious questions, religious ideas, spiritual themes, even supernatural themes, particularly for teenagers, they're very much part of everyone's day-to-day reality. So people like seeing them depicted also in media.
And of course, I think the films that were very popular about 15, 20 years ago, based on the Tolkien novels, I mean, they were deep religious allegories of Christianity. I mean, Tolkien being a very Christian writer, they must have influenced a generation, I imagine.
Absolutely. And even if we think before then, like I'm typically Gen X, Star Wars. And Star Wars, the character of Yoda is said to be also referencing like Buddhist yogi kind of masters. Those big epic battles between good and evil, they obviously evoke religious narratives and themes. And also these kind of moral dilemmas, you know, again, people often look towards religion or spirituality for those kinds of frameworks of how to be a better person or how to create a better world.
All this leads to the obvious question, Anna. Has Hollywood, in that broadest sense, become the new missionary? Is Hollywood the place that's bringing the converts or softening the hearts?
Well, I think it's a great question because the thing is, like film and media and television, it's a bit like it's similar to education. Like they are often part of nation building projects. And in more authoritarian regimes, there can be absolute propaganda in terms of pushing a particular narrative about national identity. I don't know how much Hollywood is becoming that. I think Hollywood's probably kind of always been that. There's also internal diversity within Hollywood around what is that narrative? You know, is the narrative diversity, like something like the show Nobody Wants This, that is really grappling with interreligious marriage or marriage between a Jewish person and a non-religious person, something like White Lotus, which is like full of spiritual themes and Buddhism, or something that is more literally messianic and has a really strong conservative Christian narrative. And there's also a bit of an attraction to some of these more conservative narratives and Christianity, like in terms of family values and things that people watch together across generations.
Yeah. On White Lotus, Anna, my thought, though, about the interaction between religion / spirituality / wellness and wealth, as it were, in the White Lotus series, because the White Lotus is built around this premise of very privileged, wealthy people going to tourist destinations that are usually staffed by people who are, if not poor, then certainly the working class of those communities. And the wellness industry helps those wealthy people just feel a bit more positive about themselves without asking too much real change.
Yeah, and I think this has been definitely critique of contemporary spirituality and wellness for some time. There's the famous book Selling Spirituality by Corrett and King, and many other studies that focus on those kind of more darker sides of wellness and spirituality. And it is really interesting because we are seeing some of these more concerning things about spirituality and abuse of power and things like conspirituality, fusion of spirituality and conspiracy theories. But we're also seeing that maybe it's a lot less elite now than what it used to be. Spirituality is really mainstream now. Even in the so-called elite spaces, there also does seem to be quite a lot of sincerity, like a lot of people who are running businesses that are really successful spiritual businesses. Many of them have had kind of personal crises or crises of health or faith within their families. And they've kind of turned their whole life around and really seem to be genuinely trying to be better people and to create a better world.
Anna Halifoff of Deakin University. That's it for this episode. Follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and audio panel beater Roy Huberman. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.